Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. June 6th this year marks the 75th anniversary of D-Day, the Allied invasion of France in 1944, and serves as a means by which we will all need to take time out to appreciate our freedom and the incredible sacrifices of those who fought to ensure it. Today's story delves into the life of a man that the Allies fought against in World War II and World War I, a German general named Erwin Rommel. My intention is not to paint him as a hero, but as a capable adversary who showed many of the qualities that most of us would want in our own leaders. He would have made a great American or British general, but he was born in Germany, loyal to Germany, and fought for the Führer, and died by order of the Führer when it was found that he was involved with the men who had plotted Hitler's death. Rommel did not participate in the killing of Jews or the killing of prisoners of war. There are two types of generals. There are fighting generals who seem to draw their very existence from being involved directly in the battle. And there are political generals whose skills lay in planning strategies, organizing and improving, and providing the necessary link between their armies and their government's leaders. Erwin Rommel, who many say was a fighting general, fought for Germany in two world wars, was wounded 5 times on 5 separate occasions, and is the only German general out of hundreds whose name has survived World War II intact. Today we're covering the life of Rommel, one of history's best-known generals. His military career began early in World War I, where he threw himself into the action, taking part in dangerous raids and reconnaissance missions throughout the Great War, as it was called. His men were heard to have said, "Where Rommel is, there is the front." He had originally been an admirer of Hitler, and like most Germans, had no idea of the atrocities that were being committed against Jews, Poles, Dutch, and Slavic peoples in concentration camps. When he was asked to support a conspiracy to take Hitler out of the action, he agreed, that according to papers left by his wife, but objected to killing Hitler, believing that Hitler should be imprisoned, not murdered, and that Germany be surrendered to stop further bloodshed. During the height of Rommel's success in North Africa, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill sang his praises before the House of Commons. "We have a very daring and skillful opponent against us," Churchill declared, "and may I say across the havoc of war, a great general." In North Africa, Rommel, commanding the tank divisions battling against the British, engineered a series of maneuvers that kept the Germans in the battle months longer than expected due to serious shortages in gas and provisions, earning him the moniker, the Desert Fox. He ignored Hitler's written orders to fight to the last man and burned Hitler's orders to kill all Allied commanders they captured. Then, in the wake of the D-Day invasion, Allied aircraft strafed his open-topped car as it rode through Normandy, France, causing it to somersault off the road. When the dust cleared, Rommel was unconscious, with multiple skull fractures and glass fragments in his face. Soon after, when Operation Valkyrie, the plot to assassinate Hitler, failed on July 20, 1944, Rommel was named as one of the conspirators. He was left with the choice to be shot or take a suicide pill. In order to cover up the subsequent forced suicide of the popular general, Nazi officials told the public he had died as a result of the strafing. The truth didn't come out until the conclusion of the conflict. Today we cover the life of the man they called the Desert Fox. We're very glad to have with us today Samuel W. Mitchum, Jr., the author of the new book, Desert Fox, The Storied Military Career of Erwin Rommel. Sandy, it's great to have you with us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me.
Would you mind giving us a little bit on your background, and why do you think it's important for people to learn about Rommel?
I've got a PhD from the University of Tennessee. I was a professor for 20 years at University of Louisiana Monroe, Henderson State University, Georgia Southern University. I was visiting professor at West Point. I was active in the reserve, graduate of Command and General Staff College, things of that nature. I think history itself is important, and Troy Beaton, one of the major figures in history, historiography, historical thought, said, write biographies. History is nothing more than the biographies of great men. Now, I don't agree with that 100%, but there's a lot of truth in it. We learn a lot from studying the great men and women of history, people who are movers and shakers and molded their times. Rommel was one of those people we can learn a lot from. He had strong beliefs, strong principles, and was willing to die for them. Proved on more than one occasion he was willing to die for Germany, but Germany breaks courage into two different parts, physical courage and civic courage. A lot of the German generals and SS generals and what have you had physical courage, that's undeniable, but they didn't have civil courage, a lot of them. Otherwise, they would have overthrown Hitler before they tried to. They would have denounced Nazism and stood up to the dictatorship, and the world would have probably been a better place. Rommel had civic courage. When he found out what Hitler actually was, what was actually going on, he joined the conspiracy to assassinate him. Now, Rommel didn't want Hitler assassinated. He wanted Hitler arrested and put on trial so the German people could find out what he actually was. He was afraid if they murdered him, Hitler would become a great Nazi martyr. Of course, Rommel was being a little naive here because in 1944, I don't think you could come up with a plausible scenario where Hitler was arrested and not rescued by the Nazis, not freed. I don't think it was physically possible to have him arrested and put on trial. But that's what Rommel wanted. The assassination attempt failed. The Gestapo found out that Rommel was involved in a plot to overthrow the Third Reich. And they offered him an opportunity to commit suicide, or he could stand trial before the People's Court. And he said he would stand trial. And Hitler's two emissaries, Generals Burgdorf and Meissel, told him that, if he stood trial, they would take the routine steps against his family. Which meant they would end up in a concentration camp if they were lucky. Germany had a doctrine that they applied in those days, Schreppenhof, collective family responsibility. In other words, it would not be possible for you to commit a crime. Your whole family would be implicated in the crime. And rather than have his family murdered, Rommel said, I'll be dead in 15 minutes. And he was dead within a half an hour.
How did he earn the moniker Desert Fox?
Well, that just sort of happened. Apparently the British came up with it first because he was taking them to the woodshed. And The nickname crossed the lines, and the German propaganda machine under Goebbels picked up on it. They saw an opportunity, and they knew an opportunity when they saw it. So they made him a hero. And Rommel went along with that. I think he liked playing the hero. He had an almost American sense of public relations, which German generals in general didn't have. And say what you want to about Goebbels. He was a terrible person, but he could spin a yarn. And that caught the imagination of the German people. And also Rommel caught the imagination of the British people, too, because he beat them fiercely about the head and shoulders so frequently. But he insisted on waging war in as a civilized a manner as possible.
Do you have any?
Go ahead.
Do you have any anecdotes or stories from the North African campaign as it applies to Rommel?
Oh yeah, quite a few.
Could you share a few?
Sure. Well, what Rommel liked to do was go out to the front on a daily basis. He didn't confine himself to headquarters. He once said that no admiral ever won a battle from a shore base. And he was always up front with the troops, and they loved that. He ate the same things they ate and underwent the same privations they did. And developed a reputation as a superman because he wasn't afraid of anything. One German soldier talked about it. They were in attack, and they hit the dirt. They were pinned down. They were afraid to raise up their heads because they might get shot. They were ready to cut the buttons off their uniform so they could get closer to the ground. And the next thing you know, Rommel strides up fully erect and says, "What the hell is the matter with you fellas? Just because it gets a little hot over here doesn't mean you have to belly flop every time." And he got the attack going again. And as soon as he left, there were casualties again. And the saying in the Africa Corps was, no bullet was made. They will hit the old man. And that wasn't true, of course. He was wounded 5 times during the war, severely. During World War One and World War Two, he held the wounded badge in gold for being wounded 5 times. But it developed a camaraderie. He made them feel like they were elite troops, and they weren't. They were just regular German draftees, but they became what he wanted them to be, which was elite troops. One of his lieutenants, if anyone who came under his spell, became a real soldier.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
And he insisted on treating POWs properly. There was a volunteer Jewish battalion in the Free French Brigade, and Rommel captured it. And Hitler sent an order that they were to be terminated with extreme prejudice. They would be shot. And Rommel and his operations officer, Siegfried Westphal, went behind Rommel's command vehicle and burned it. The troops never saw it. The Jews were turned over to the Italians, who treated them like regular allied POWs. And some of these men ended up in the Israeli army in the late 40s. But he was always doing what he thought was right, and that didn't always entail obeying orders. but he insisted on a civilized warfare could be waged. The British ordered that any Germans who were taken prisoner were not to be given water until after they had been interrogated, and that flew all over Rommel. And he issued the same order to his men and sent a letter to Auchinleck, who was then the British commander-in-chief, and basically told him that that has to be rescinded. And Auchinleck rescinded it immediately. I'm not sure he even knew it had been issued, but he found out. And as soon as that happened, Rommel rescinded his order, and the British were given water. He was easy for his men to get along with. He was a lot tougher on officers. He was a major, von Militain, said that it required nerves of steel to work for Rommel. He was harsher on his officers.
How did Rommel get along with Hitler? Hitler was trying to run the war from Berlin, right? And I understand it, and from what your book shares, that they were often at odds. How did that... What exactly happened there? How did he handle Hitler's commands?
That's a moving target. Very different in 1938 than it was in 1944. Rommel distinguished himself in World War One, the Battle of Matajar. He captured 9,000 Italians. He had less than 800 men under his command, and captured 9,000 Italians and 81 guns. A few days later, at Langhorne, he captured 10,000 Italians, won the Pour le Mérite, the equivalent of the Medal of Honor. And in the 1930s, he wrote a book based on his experiences and the lectures he gave at the War Academy. Well, the book became a bestseller, and Adolf Hitler read it and wanted to meet the man who wrote the book. So he named him acting commander of the Führer Bodyguard Battalion during the Sudetenland crisis, and later in Czechoslovakia and Memel, all of which were bloodless conquests, and then later in Poland. He liked Rommel, and at that time, Rommel liked him. You've got to remember that if Adolf Hitler had died, say, in 1937, we would think of him entirely differently than we think of him today. He did some good things in the 30s. He eliminated unemployment in Germany. He had massive public works projects that benefited everyone, including the Autobahns. He restored the military draft. You could say he made Germany great again. And he made outlandish comments about the Jews, but that wasn't taken so seriously until before Kristallnacht. There was some discrimination, but there's a lot of difference in little discrimination and putting someone in a gas chamber. So the German people liked him, and he was very popular, and Rommel liked him. Only later did it turn out that these outlandish statements were totally serious. And Hitler changed over time. I think personally that he was on a delicate mental perch that he eventually fell off of. Anyway, after the Polish campaign, Rommel approached Hitler and said, "Mein Führer, I would like a command." Hitler took a personal interest in him by now and said, "What do you want?" And Rommel said, "To command a Panzer division." And Rommel later admitted that was an extremely immodest request on my part, because there were literally hundreds of officers better qualified for that than he was. As far as I know, he never got inside a tank before 1938. This was 1939. And he'd spent his entire career in the infantry or in the mountain branch. But Hitler gave him command of the 7th Panzer Division in France, and Rommel made the best of it. He had about 10,000 men in his unit, and he captured over 97,000 Frenchmen and Allied soldiers, including several British generals. He captured 5 admirals. He ran over the naval base for the French Atlantic Fleet. He really distinguished himself. And then after the Italian army collapsed in North Africa, Hitler gave him command of the Africa Corps. Now, that was really just a blocking force. That was Hitler's idea. Hitler, and I think quite correctly, said the loss of North Africa could be withstood from a military point of view. However, it would free up a dozen British divisions, which they could use most dangerously. And certainly, he was right there. So Rommel inherited a sideshow, and he immediately expanded his scope well beyond his original orders. He overran all of Libya except for the fortress of Tobruk, which held out in his rear, and he kicked the rear end of the Western Desert Force, the British 13th Corps, and the British 8th Army, and won some spectacular victories. But North Africa was always a secondary front to Hitler and the Nazis. The British, on the other hand, it was their only active theater of operations. They poured all sorts of resources into it. They were very frustrated they couldn't defeat Rommel. Now, meanwhile, in Europe, I mean, they had Rommel had 2 divisions in North Africa. It was later increased to 4. Hitler committed over 150 divisions to the Eastern Front. And that's where we got to see Nazism for what it really was. We got to see Hitler as a mass murderer. He was killing Jews, and, Gypsies, and Slavs, and anybody else he didn't like. Rommel was isolated in North Africa. He didn't see that for a long time. I don't think he found out about the Holocaust until about 1943. He was in Italy, and somebody told him what was actually going on. And we don't know who. I mean, obviously, whoever did it swore Rommel to secrecy, and Rommel never broke that confidence. But his son, Manfred, he had one child by his married wife. And Manfred liked the SS uniforms, which were unquestionably sharp-looking. It's one reason the SS got a lot of recruits, kind of like the U.S. Marine Corps today. Those two service groups, I think, have the best-looking uniforms of the 20th century. Manfred wanted to join the SS, and Erwin Rommel said, "You absolutely will not. I will not allow it." And that took Manfred by surprise, because his daddy never talked to him that way. He treated him almost as an adult, sit down, had father and son discussions. But this time it was a categorical imperative, and Manfred asked him, why not? And Rommel said, "Because I will not allow you to serve under a murderer." Manfred asked, "Do you mean Himmler?" "Yes, he's conducting mass murders in the East." And Manfred asked, "Is Hitler involved?" And Rommel said, "I don't know. But the implication was, I will find out." And he did. He found out Hitler was involved. Then he turned against him. So the relationship devolved.
As you and I talk today, we're approaching the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Rommel, I believe, was responsible for the coastal defenses of France. How did he set them up, and what happened on D-Day?
Well, Rommel believed in mines, mines, and mines. He had anti-tank mines. He had anti-personnel mines. He had held up the British 8th Army for three whole weeks at Allala, Maine. And that was a prelude to the defense of Normandy and Western Europe. It was the antithesis of the Blitzkrieg. At Allala, Maine, Rommel was out of petroleum. He had three issues of fuel in the army when the British attacked, which is enough for 3 days. But he held them off for 3 weeks, largely using mines and various other tricks. Normandy sort of pulled the same thing. He believed that if the Allies had 48 hours to land and dig in, Germany would never be able to get rid of them. His exact words were, "There would be little hope for us." And he laid more than twice as many mines in 6 months as the Germans had laid in 4 years. And also, he wanted to bring the units close to the coast so they could launch immediate counterattacks. I put in my book the units that he wanted to move to Normandy. Rommel suspected the Allies were going to come ashore at Normandy because he analyzed their bombing pattern and realized that they were trying to make a strategic island out of Normandy. They didn't want the Germans to be able to bring up reinforcements, so they were blowing up bridges and railroads. And at the same time, they weren't mining the water off the coast of Normandy. Of course, you wouldn't want to mine the waters if you were going to send your invasion fleet there. At Calais, there were a lot of mines. So Rommel wanted to bring up, for example, the 12th SS Panzer Division Hitler Youth, which in my opinion was the best unit on either side to fight in Normandy, with the possible exception of some of the airborne divisions, which were well trained, but they weren't nearly as well equipped as the Hitler Youth. And he wanted to bring up the entire 3rd Flak Corps, which was armed primarily with 88s. They would have made hash out of our tanks. He also brought in better units. I mean, look at Omaha Beach. It was initially defended by the German 77th Infantry Division, which was made up of Volksdeutsch, ethnic Germans. Many of them couldn't even speak German. They were Polish. And they put one battalion to defend Omaha Beach. And that's the only way, looking at Omaha Beach, can make sense. They thought they would not be willing to fight for Germany. And indeed, they probably wouldn't have been. And they, on May 11th, 3 weeks before D-Day, Rommel inspected Omaha Beach, or what became Omaha Beach, and said he was in a bad mood, and he thought the 77th was inferior. So he ordered it replaced with the 352nd. Infantry Division, which was made up of young German boys who were true believers in the cause and who had spent 2 years on the Eastern Front. And he didn't put one battalion there, he put an entire regiment, three battalions basically. And we didn't know this. The French resistance found out about it quickly, of course, and they notified Allied headquarters in the usual way, carrier pigeons. Well, Rommel knew that they were sending carrier pigeons, so he lined the whole coast up with men who, they had nothing else to do, were equipped with shotguns, and their duty was to shoot pigeons. And the French, of course, knew that too. So they would send each message on different days by two different pitches, because they figured it would take a major stroke of luck for the Germans to shoot both pitches. Well, you know, kind of like the Titanic and any other disaster, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. The Rommel shotgunners shot down both pigeons. So we didn't know that Omaha Beach was being defended by veterans of the Eastern Front until D-Day had been in progress for several hours. And then, we got unlucky too. The weather was bad. Of course, Eisenhower made the greatest decision of his life and one of the greatest decisions of the war to go ahead despite the marginal weather. But on Omaha Beach, they were going to bomb it with B-17s, which would require instrument bombing. And General Doolittle, the Air Force commander, went to General Eisenhower and wanted to add 2 or 3 seconds to the bombing approach, because bombing by instrument in 1944 was a dangerous thing. If they released the bombs early, it would have landed on our fleet as the men were getting into the landing crafts. That would have been a disaster. So they added 2 to 3 seconds per bomb drop. As a result, the bombs fell 2 miles inland. And all that did, it didn't hurt the German defenses at all, but it did wake them up and say, hey, look, something's coming. Because it was a major bomb run. And if you read the reports and the interviews of the Allied men in the landing craft, they talk about as they were approaching the beach, they could hear the German marking rounds striking their landing craft. They were getting ready for them to drop the ramp, and when they did, cut them to pieces. And, D-Day was a major disaster on Omaha Beach. We barely clung on to it. It was still in question. As night fell on June 6th, and had Rommel been given the mobile reserves that he had requested from Hitler, I don't think there's much doubt Omaha Beach would have been wiped out, and Utah Beach would have been in danger.
Rommel was not present during D-Day, right? Was he back in Berlin?
No, he was back in his Herrlingen, in the little village that his wife was in, southwestern Germany. That June 6th was her birthday. And he was going to Berchtesgaden to meet with Hitler on June 7th. He got the weather reports, said that it was going to be lousy. Rain was already beginning to fall at his headquarters when he left on June 5th. He figured it was safe. He'd actually bought her a pair of shoes for her birthday because they were running low in Germany. And it, got there, and ironically enough, the shoes didn't even fit. But he didn't get back to his headquarters in France until about 10:30 on June 6th at night. He couldn't get the counterattack going quickly enough to throw the Allies back into the sea.
And for those next few days, what did he try to do to stem the tide?
Well, he tried to get a counterattack going, but it was June 9th before that happened. And he got up the Panzer Division. One of his subordinates, Dolman at 7th Army, made a major mistake, ordered it to move forward at daylight. What the Germans call the Jabos, the Allied fighter bombers, tore it limb from limb. But what was left of it attacked just exactly at the same time and place as Montgomery launched an attack, and it was a head-on collision, but the Germans didn't win, didn't really lose, but they didn't win either, and the tie went to the Allies, basically, because they could build up a lot faster than Rommel could because of Hitler's interference. It's one of the ironies of World War II. Hitler decided that Normandy would be the target until the first Allied soldier put his foot on the beach. Then he decided it was a diversion, and the real invasion would come at the port of Calais.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
He insisted on keeping the infantry there. The German infantry stayed up in the northern zone, 15th Army. Now, Rommel was in Normandy, and Normandy is great country for infantry. If you go there today, the terrain's changed considerably. You'll find very few hedgerows. Back in those days, it was covered in hedgerows, and a Norman hedgerow is not like the American hedge that you have on your lawn. They were usually 6, 8, or 10 feet tall, and they were earthen dikes is what they were, they had shrubs growing in them and even trees. They made great infantry positions. But Rommel couldn't get his infantry. Hitler did give him panzer divisions, so the panzer divisions were bled white in Normandy. And when the Allies broke out in this, the interior of France, which is excellent tank country, the Germans didn't have any more tanks. That's when Hitler brought up the infantry, and they were swamped by people like Patton. And that's why one reason France fell so quickly.
Question for you. Who was it who first brought Rommel in on the attempt to take Hitler out of action? And exactly what was done and what was planned to try and do that? What happened?
Oh, there was a Luftwaffe lieutenant colonel named Offata. And he was the son of a general that Rommel knew in World War One and highly respected. He was the main mover and shaker in bringing Rommel in. His family had a lot of influence with Rommel, and they had a frank discussion. I wish I had the transcript of it, but no one does. It doesn't exist. But he was the first one. Rommel became more and more interested in it. He had a falling out with his chief of staff, Goss. What had happened, Goss and he worked very well together in Africa, and Goss's home was bombed out in the Allied bombing raids, and Frau Rommel took Frau Goss in. And they were living together with Rommel's family, but the two women could not get along. It created a rift between the two families, and Rommel had to replace his chief of staff. He did it with a man named Dr. Speidel, who wanted to assassinate Hitler, and he got Rommel deeper and deeper into the plot, although Rommel never wanted to kill Hitler. He wanted him on trial, and Speidel was in charge on D-Day, and kind of made a mess of things. He didn't contact Rommel until very late in the morning. D-Day had already been going on for several hours before Rommel even got the phone call. And Rommel immediately realized this was the invasion. And as soon as he hung up, he just sat down and shook his head and said, "How stupid of me. How stupid of me." And he immediately returned to France, but it was too late.
How has history treated Rommel? How has he emerged from history as just a brilliant general on the losing side? Is there anything more to him?
Well, as a man willing to sacrifice himself for his principles, and it's always refreshing in history But mainly as a brilliant general, that's what he devoted his life to, was the profession of arms. And that's what he's gone down as. The British liked him. But part of that was, frankly, he beat us, so therefore he must be the best. And Churchill, of course, was obsessed with defeating him. One time he yelled in Parliament, "Rommel, Rommel, Rommel, what else matters but beating him?" It's kind of the way it felt. He even said words to the effect in Parliament of, "Cross the havoc of war, I must say, he is a very great general." And he was. He's very good at it. He wasn't perfect. No one ever is. But he did very well.
Yeah, I especially enjoyed the parts in your book that brought him from his early experiences in World War I, where he turned out to be a tremendous leader early on, and then through to his services during World War II. He was a well-disciplined person. As I recall, no alcohol, no faults. He was loyal to others, as he was with his with the mother of his first child. And he was loyal to the people around him. His soldiers loved him. And he was well-respected all around. For a guy who had spent a good 25, 30 years in the military, he had worked his way all the way up the ladder and done it because of his leadership abilities, his ability to learn, his ability to make decisions during critical times, during tense situations, and always seem to come out on top. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes. Yes, it was. And he had a whole different leadership mantra. And indeed, all the Germans did it. Opposed to the British. I mean, the British Army headquarters in one of the operations was 60 miles behind the front. And Rommel was up front with the troops. He could influence things immediately. And by the time the British would react, it was too late. And it happened on many occasions. But yeah, that's a good assessment. As one of his staff officers said, he was, if anything, too tough on himself and everybody else. He never asked anybody to do anything he wasn't willing to do himself, but he was willing to push himself to the max. Even Hitler said that Erwin Rommel was the hardest man he ever met. He would go days with very little sleep, very little food. He didn't care what he ate. Often he forgot to eat.
What do you think are some similarities and differences between Rommel and Patton?
There are more similarities than differences. Patton was, of course, obsessed with fighting Rommel, meeting him in battle and defeating him, and he was disappointed he never really got to. Of course, when Tunisia, when the troops first clashed, Patton was commanding a corps, which is much smaller than Rommel's command in Africa, which was at that time an army group. Rommel appreciated Patton, but at that time didn't look on him as much more than another talented Allied commander. That changed after Rommel was wounded. Now, Rommel was wounded on July 17th. Patton broke through at the end of July, broke out of Normandy and overran France. And Rommel only heard about it from reports and so forth, but he said, he talked about how awesome that was, and we were watching possibly the greatest campaign in the history of armored warfare for Patton's walk through France. So he admired Patton, especially there toward the end. They were very different people. You know, Patton was very profane. They both, you know, believed in maneuver. And they both did it very well. The difference was Patton always outnumbered the enemy, generally did, whereas Rommel always fought outnumbered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. That's a great point. I always saw Patton as a man who pretty much saw himself as a general of destiny. He had studied all the old battles and saw himself as a modern-day general on the same level as a Napoleon, for instance. And I think he pictured himself differently. And Rommel, I don't know how much he was the same. Rommel was just pretty much purely a military polished button type of guy who was going to get it done any way he could. And you're right, he always did seem to be outnumbered. And that seemed to be the mark to his fame.
Yes, Wolf Huyckman wrote a book about it. And he said that Rommel was one of those men who rose directly in proportional to the task at hand. The worse off he was in terms of numerical strength, the better he became. But like I say, there are more similarities than differences between Patton and Rommel.
Well, they both died premature deaths. Do you believe Patton was murdered?
I don't know. I'm of two minds of it. I've heard the conspiracy theories. And I don't discount them. It could have been. There were definitely people who'd like to have gotten rid of him now with a resort to murder, I couldn't say. If they did murder him, they covered it up pretty good. On the other hand, Patton was a little bit accident-prone. It seems to me that the accident that he was involved in, no one else was hurt. So why would he be paralyzed? So. I just wonder myself. I think that's one of history's little mysteries that we're never going to really know the answer to.
Did Rommel leave any mysteries for history to worry over?
No, not really. He was a very straightforward man. And that's one thing. Patton routinely cheated on his wife and was terrified that she might find out about it. Rommel never did. Mm-hmm. That's one of the major differences. But Rommel
character
didn't leave any major holes, any major questions. So it's a fairly straightforward story. Rommel was not a terribly complex person. He was a simple soldier with certain standards that he would not compromise, and pretty tough taskmaster, but not a harsh one. Loved his family. He loved his country. He respected his men. I mean, even in World War One, he developed correspondence with his old buddies, the enlisted men who had served with him, and they corresponded. And even during World War Two, when he had a whole lot to do, he always answered their letters. He would sit down and handwrite them. Very rarely did he have somebody type. But he wasn't particularly sentimental in that respect. He had certain friends, but never... you didn't get too familiar with Rommel. I guess is normal for a general officer in a combat situation. You didn't want to get too close to anybody because they could be killed at any moment.
So, Sandy, how do people contact you? Could you give us a website or Facebook addresses and also let them know how they can get a hold of your book?
The book, you can contact Regular History, it's a publisher, but it's on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble, and most bookstores now, I understand. And Samuel mentioned Facebook. Yeah, I guess that's the best way. Or send me a letter, care of Regular History, Washington, D.C.
Well, it's been great having you with us today. I know that our listeners are going to enjoy the story. The book is The Desert Fox, The Storied Military Career of Erwin Rommel by Samuel W. Mitchum, Jr. And Sandy, thank you so much for being with us today. And I wish you luck with this book and with everything else that you do. It's been wonderful having the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.